Hello, hello, and welcome to Soil Matters. My name's Tanya, and before we go any further, I want to pay respect to the elders and Indigenous caretakers across this planet, past, present, and future. This is just a little get-together to discuss all things soil. It's kind of an attempt to recognize our privilege as humans in this big ecosystem, and it's also an attempt to merge perspectives from the physical and social sciences, arts and literatures. The world is run by those who show up. That's what Professor Marsha Langton Am said. And well, who's shown up today is Dave Von Vase, who is just finishing off his PhD at the Freie Universität and has been busy working on modelling fire emissions for the last couple of years. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Good, wonderful. And yeah, so I guess I gave a little bit of an intro as to like what you've been researching, and I want to ask you a lot more questions about your research and what you've been diving into, and just feel free to answer as big or small as you like. But first, I really like to ask you to like paint a bit of a picture about like what your upbringing was like and what was going on for you in those early years. Like, I'd love to hear a little bit about like a bit of a sketch as to what life was like at home for you and what kind of the landscape or the sort of area that you grew up in, how that felt and kind of how you feel that maybe led or didn't lead to your position here now as a PhD student studying fire emissions.
Yeah. Yeah, so I grew up in Meidrecht, which is a village quite close to Amsterdam, actually. It's about 30 kilometers from here. And yeah, it's really a polar landscape. So it actually has a big history with peat. So a lot of peat has been delved there in the past. And that really... yeah, that really defines the landscape now there. So it's there's these lakes that used to be peat landscapes, and the rest is just agricultural fields, basically. So yeah, I was raised there in a family of four. So my parents and my sister. I would say a mid-income family, and. Yeah, if you ask me like, how did I experience that? How did I feel? I would say I was often not very happy about like these landscapes around me, because it was also managed and also so anthropogenic, basically.
Yeah, because it's a bit of a juxtaposition, right? That there's all these open spaces, but they're not really open spaces where there's nature.
Yeah, exactly. And I was often told like, this is nature, and but I never really accepted that. I felt like this is not nature. I mean, it's not. It's so managed. Like, it's not nature. That's always what I felt like. Later on, I changed that view a bit, and changed a bit more towards the idea that, like, even if there's a tree in a large managed field, that's still nature, and the grass there is also nature, and like, it's a matter of perspectives in the end.
What changed your perspective on that one?
Growing older, I guess, a bit less narrow-minded, a bit less pessimistic, think.
Yeah, I guess as you get older, or as I get older, I get a bit more happy to settle for what is not my ideal.
Yeah.
Able to settle for what is not my ideal.
Yeah, 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 exactly. It's something like that, yeah.
And were, like, when you're like, when you're saying you were looking around you at these open spaces and some people are calling it nature and you're feeling a bit, yeah, disappointed with this perspective, then, who were you having conversations with about that?
Yeah, I used to share those feelings together with a good friend of mine, which I've known for a long time, and we shared those perspectives, and we felt very similar in a lot of ways, and we kind of were able to express those feelings in making music and.
Mm.
But besides that, it was difficult to get an ear for those feelings. Like, a lot of people wouldn't understand what I was so pessimistic about, in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, an audience of one is not a very large audience.
Yeah, but still, it was enough. I think it felt like enough. Yeah. We were always craving for more forest, and we were listening to those Scandinavian bands, and we're like, "Oh, that is nature," in Norway and Sweden, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And were there many discussions about nature or the environment or like the politics around nature or the environment at home with your parents or other family members?
No, not really. I think most of the conversations were about very basic things. Like, at home, it was often just about, about work things, about study. We didn't really have these deeper conversations.
And do you think that influenced, like, your decision making at school?
Yeah, I think it did, because for example, after my secondary education, I decided to study physics, with the idea of understanding things, like understanding how things work and how the world is constructed, but never with the idea of studying nature. And then later on during my studies, I realized, man, physics is way too artificial for me, in a way. It's really, when you look at applied physics, it's really again very anthropogenic, in a way. It's really focused on achieving technological development and things like that. And that's when I started realizing more of this. Yeah, the idea that I wanted to look more at nature and not at applied physics, so to say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you went, and where did you do your undergraduate studies, your bachelor studies?
Oh, bachelor's, that is, yeah.
Sorry, must be an Australian term. I just tried to slip in there.
So that was, I started in Amsterdam, at the University of Amsterdam with physics, and then I went to Delft for applied university physics, and then that's during internships, I think is the point where this realization came, like, I want to look more into nature and not all this technological stuff. So then that's why I chose a master that was more towards nature and sustainability.
Mm-hmm. And did that realization come from an interaction with something, like with something more natural, or was it because of a lack of the natural in your internships?
I felt like there was a lack of natural in my studies program, but then the internships were more into the natural stuff. So yeah, that's when I realized it more and more. So choosing those internships already was a step, I would say, towards that direction. Yeah.
And then okay, and then so then you finished your internships and you went on to do your master's. Is that right? Am I piecing it together correctly?
Yeah.
And then your what master's program was that?
So that was called Science for Energy and Sustainability. It's quite a mouthful.
That could be a few things.
Yeah, so it was actually a physics master and then a specialization. But in practice it was a really broad studies. It included some more, sustainable technology things, but there was also a lot of room to expand and choose your own things. And where there was free choice, I basically fully went for the more nature topics, or even like nature ethics and stuff like that. Because at that point I was really interested in that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And then you did that and you were finishing your master's, and why did you end up choosing this modeling kind of direction instead of something like nature ethics or something more outside? Or there's a lot of different directions you could have gone, I guess, from that point.
Yeah, and at the start of my PhD, I've actually doubted a lot about that choice.
Haven't we all?
yeah. Especially the start of a PhD, I think a lot of people still have the feeling, yeah, I can still step out. It's not too late yet.
And yeah. Now it's, I wish I stepped out.
yeah. So, wait, sorry, I kind of lost the question. Now.
How did you make the decision? For you had a few different, maybe you didn't have so many different paths in your head. Maybe the decision was quite clear to go in the modeling direction, but you just mentioned like that you were really interested in nature ethics, and I'm wondering if you were considering different paths or it was clear to go for the modeling.
Yeah.
Sort of angle.
Yeah, it was. I think it was that. I really liked that more social science stuff, I guess you could call it, or alpha sciences. But at the same time, I realized that maybe I wasn't very good at it. And it's so, in a way, the social sciences are so much more unstructured and fluid. And I realized that, at heart I'm really a beta person and I like this structure and perfectionism. So, that's how I think I realized I would like that social part of it just as a hobby, and then do the more beta stuff for work. Yeah.
All right, and then you began your PhD project, and I guess now you've got obviously you've got a really clear idea of in what direction it's taken, but I guess in the beginning when you're first telling people a little bit about your project, and maybe you need to write a short description on some forms or paperwork. Can you remember what that description was now?
Not really, actually. I came into a project that was already quite structured. So my initial tasks were quite clear and quite directed, so I never really had to make up my own research plan, actually. In a way, it was really easy to start for me. It was just like an internship, actually. Yeah, and then later on, when getting a bit deeper into the topic, yeah, that's when you could expand a bit more on your own ideas and your own directions.
Oh, yeah, okay, I'm really tempted to ask, like, at what point, did you, make it feel like you were making, like, having bigger, larger input or making bigger decisions, but I'm jumping ahead of it, so.
Let's keep that for after the break.
All right. Well, then,
No, just kidding.
So you developed this fire emissions model,
yeah.
And there, there are two types of fire emissions models, right? And maybe describe the difference between the two types better than I can, just like for the listeners.
Yeah. In a way, you can say there's two types. I guess then one would be based as much as possible on observation. So for these models, use a lot of satellite data because that gives the best global estimate for how much fire there is and what its impacts are. And then there's also models that model the fire development itself.
That would be more like would you call it a process? Would you call that a process-based model?
Yeah, I think so. So that those models really start with, there is a reason for an ignition here, an ignition source, and that creates a small fire and it starts spreading. And then that spread is modeled based on the wind directions and the dryness of the fuels and stuff like that.
The type of wood, the type of ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, not only wood, but all the fuel available. Yeah,
and then the satellite-based models, they actually observe the area that has been burned. So they take a look in the past, basically. Or no, they look at the current moment, but they're able to also look back into the past because the satellite has been already rotating around the Earth for decades. So that gives a more concrete estimate of how much area has burned and where. And to date, the process-based models are really not able to mimic, to duplicate or reproduce the burned area that we see by satellite.
Are there global process-based models? Because I haven't looked so much in literature, but when I've come across it, it's been a little bit more looking at a certain, a region.
Okay. Yeah, so there are global ones. They are usually a part of a what is called a dynamic vegetation model.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically just a module for that vegetation model. Based on the vegetation there is and the moisture and things like that, they model the propagation of fire on a global scale. And the general global patterns are captured quite well nowadays by these models, but when you look at the closer, like a smaller scale, it's really not able to reproduce the reality.
It makes a lot of sense because I understand both in weather forecasting and global climate models that wind speed is one of the most difficult to represent reliably, and the movement of a fire is very much dependent on wind speed.
Yeah, and also precipitation is really important and quite difficult to model. And then just what is even harder actually is modeling the ignition of the fire, because that's it can be lightning, which is super difficult to predict, and it can be human activity, which is even harder to predict on a global scale. So yeah, and then it's also just in a way a chance process if a fire starts. So yeah, there's a lot of unclear factors there that make it very difficult to do that.
Definitely, but I guess for modeling into the future, that's perhaps when those models are useful.
Yeah.
If you want to, yeah, be modeling into the future and get some idea of what impact fires might have on vegetation and emissions, then yeah, they are a bit more useful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, future productions, and also they also use it for paleo studies, so going all the way back. Yeah, for those studies, it's definitely the best option there is, or the only option there is, almost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I know you. So you built a bit from the ground up, but also working from a previous, an already existing model. So GFED, and you work to make a finer resolution version of that model. Do you want to say a little bit about that and what, I guess, why it was called for in the first place and what enabled you to like make this finer resolution model? I guess perhaps like some new data became available. I'm not sure though, in between the original GFED and your finer resolution version.
Yeah, so GFED stands for Global Fire Emissions Database, and it's nowadays it's kind of the, how do you call it, the reference data set that is used a lot for global emissions, so estimates of fire emissions globally. And that's a satellite-based model. So we just talked about these process-based models, but this is really one that is based on the satellite data for the current time period. So your question about why did we start making this finer resolution model? It's funny because it was not because new data became available or something like that. It had more to do with computing power, actually, because in the past, the amount of data and the computing power needed for these models was just too much to handle. So the data that I'm using is already available since the early 2000s at that high resolution. So in a way, it would have been possible to make a model like that much earlier. Only now computer power is enough and there's enough interest for it as well. Because in the past, these coarser models would suffice for the global estimates.
And so you're mainly looking, the main purpose is to look at the emissions, the carbon emissions, but like there's different gases emitted by fires. Does the model represent, like, does it just have one final carbon emissions, or are you sort of estimating the emissions of different gases and then summing them together?
So the model comes in a couple of steps, and the step that I'm working on really goes only until carbon emissions, so the amount of carbon that is burned, and then the next step is converting those to the different trace gases and aerosols, mm-hmm. So the emission factors. And that is, that's pretty much a multiplication it's really not that complex. There's quite a lack of data of emission factors in the field, and there's actually a lot of development in that right now, but so far it's just a publication of the amount of carbon that is burned, and then there's certain ratios for different gases, for CO2, for CO, for methane, etc.
Yeah, and so that ratio is assumed to be steady across different forest types, different ecosystems.
For different ecosystems, they have different values, but mm-hmm. it doesn't go much further than that up to now. So actually, someone else in this department, Roland Vernooy, he is looking into the variability in those emission factors, not just for different ecosystems, but also more in depth. So if it's burning late in the season or early in the season, which gives a difference in the completeness of the burning. And that has all to do with how wet the fuels are and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of spatial variability and factors that can influence the emission factors. But yeah, it just requires a lot more field campaigns to figure that variability out and then implement it into models. But yeah, there's definitely big steps being made right now to improve those estimates.
And I know you also went out into the field a couple of times.
Yeah, that's right. I once went with Roland to South Africa. That was great. I mean, being a pure modeler, it was quite a chance to go out into the field and join him on the campaign. So there we used drones to fly over the smoke from fires, and then the drones had bags, like plastic bags attached that would suck up the gas from the fire, and then we could analyze that afterwards in the lab with a gas analyzer, and then you can see what gases are emitted by the fire and in what amounts, in what ratios. So that gives a good idea of the emission factors in the end.
Do you know the saying that everyone trusts observations except the person that took the observations, and no one trusts models except for the modeler?
Yeah, and that's so true. Yeah, that's so true. But I think in general, I mean, the things that you're working on yourself, you know all the details of, so you also know all the weaknesses.
Yeah.
And for someone that looks at it from the outside, sees more the sees much less of the weaknesses and therefore trusts it more. And I think that's good, because there's also too much nitpicking, I think. There can be too much. And often the person working at it, him or herself, might actually make it a bit too difficult for himself. Getting into too much detail.
Yeah, true. And so the radio show, it's called Soil Matters. So I want to ask you about how you represented the soil in the version of the model you've been working on. As far as I remember, in a conversation a long time ago, I think you told me you had two soil layers. I'm not sure if that's true.
Soil is definitely an important aspect of the global fire emissions. And in the model, there's two specific regions where we model soil. That is the boreal region, the boreal forest, where there's a lot of organic carbon in the soil, and also peat. Well, peat in the end is just a type of organic carbon, right?
Very carbon, like a very organic matter rich carbon.
Yeah,
rich,
just a dense
soil.
Version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is one area, and then the other area is peatlands in the tropics, and that is, yeah, that's almost entirely in Indonesia and Malaysia as well a bit. So there you have the very dense peatlands where the peat layer can be a couple of meters thick. And those peatlands in a natural state are actually not that burnable because they're quite wet, but because of human influence, they become burnable. Because for converting the peatlands to agricultural land, mostly for palm oil plantations, they make dredging canals around the fields, and that drains the peatlands. So the moist is removed, and then the peat becomes dry, and because of that it becomes burnable. And then if that catches fire, that causes a lot of CO2 or carbon emissions and CO2, CO, etc. And it's really difficult to extinguish because it's an underground fire and it can be smoldering for a really long time in those peatlands.
How do they do it, extinguish it? Do you have any idea? You might not know, so don't feel...
Yeah, so the only way to really extinguish these fires is by, how do you call it, by pumping water into the soils, basically. And just flying over with a fire extinguishing plane, for example, is not enough, because it really has to go deep into the soil, the water, otherwise it won't be extinguished, because it will keep smoldering. And the same is true for the boreal soils. We saw that 2019, for example, in Russia, with these really big fires. And last year again, actually. Well, but this year again.
Do those fires start naturally or in the boreal region? Like in the boreal regions like Russia? Or are they like just by accident by humans? Or because they're not using them for agricultural use, so it's a little bit different. Or they might be, but not in the same scale, I imagine.
Yeah, so in Russia, these fires that we hear about in the news are mostly lightning ignited, so natural fires. That is a bit further north in Russia. These fires are all natural, and yeah, because the climate becomes hotter and drier there, these fires are able to become bigger and get out of hand more and more. And then more in the south of Russia, there's a lot of agricultural activity, and there the fires are more more human caused. But yeah, as I said, like these big wildfires that we hear about in the news about Russia, those are mostly natural fires.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you've got these two areas where mm-hmm. you represent the soil.
Yeah, and for the other areas on the globe, we for now do not include any soil emissions, soil
mm-hmm.
fire emissions. And that's, yeah, that's actually simply because we don't know that much about how the fire propagates in the soil there. I think for a lot of areas, it is known that the soil is hardly affected, so in a way we do know.
Mm.
But at the same time, for temperate forests, for example, it is not well known how much of the soil is burned, or if it is burned at all. That has again a lot to do with what type of fire is raging at that moment. It can be a fire that is really engulfing the whole tree in flames, but it can also be fires that only burn out the litter layer, and how that affects the burn depth into the soil, that is quite unknown for these regions.
So particularly you are interested in the burn depths in the beneath the surface, and from there do you make an estimate of like the bulk density or the organic matter content. I guess so then from there you make some kind of calculation to get an estimate of the carbon loss.
Yeah, actually the soil burning is represented quite crudely in the model, again because there's just not that much known, and it would be sucking out of the dump if you would include more complexity, basically. But it's a simple parameterization function that is based on the soil moisture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So drier soils means deeper burn depth, and then indeed we use bulk density, just one number for tropical peatlands and one number for boreal peatlands, and then a burn depth, and that combined gives you an estimate of how much of the soil is burned, and then we assume that all of that soil has been emitted by fire. So yeah,
but that's already quite some ambiguity, I guess, because it would be difficult to map like the burn depth for one, and well, yeah, you take one value for the bulk density,
yeah,
and the soil moisture.
Yeah, the soil moisture in itself is already a problem, because global soil moisture is just, there's so many factors and so many uncertainties involved, especially when we also look at the temporal signal. So our model is monthly, so you would also have to know how the soil moisture changes over time throughout the year. Yeah, and because it's quite difficult to observe that from space or with satellites, yeah, that's problematic. There's actually a lot of development now in that area as well, with I think with radar data and things like that, where soil moisture can be estimated from space. But that is mostly in areas with little tree cover. When there are trees involved, then the tree canopy blocks the signal and it's really difficult to figure out. Yeah.
Okay, my last soil question is, and what did you find about what did you estimate and find about the emissions or the carbon burnt in the soils? Was it sizable or considerable, negligible?
That's a good question. I don't really have those numbers in my head right now. I can say, however, that in the last couple of years, the amount of soil burning in the boreal has been much more quantified. There have been a lot of field campaigns, especially in North America, and it really shows that from the total fire emissions in the boreal region, and that I mean like the natural fires in the boreal region, so the lightning caused wildfires, that about 70-80% of those emissions come from the soils, and only 20-30% from the trees and the litter layer.
Above the surface.
Yeah, everything above the surface. So I thought that was quite surprising. I mean, when you see those fires and you see the trees engulfed in flames, and then realizing that only that what you see above the surface is only 20-30% of the emissions. That just shows how much carbon is in the soils.
Yeah, it's the tip of the iceberg. What's above the trees are just the tip.
Yeah, and the burn depths in these areas is from say 5-20 and max 30 centimeters. So it's not even that much.
No. How do you know the burn depth? Sorry, I'm asking another soil question.
No, that's fine. I mean, this is a soil channel, right? So yeah, that's mostly because of this huge field campaign efforts in the last couple of years in North America. So now there's a database of about 900 field plots where they all record the above ground biomass and also the below ground carbon pool, the soil pools, and also then have estimates of how much has been burned. So most of these measurements are done after fires, and they can estimate how much soil there was before the fire based on the roots of the trees. That's actually pretty interesting, I think. So a tree, in these new leaf trees in the boreal regions, they have little roots that are always just underneath the surface. They're called adventitious roots. And when a fire has been there, the amount of there's a part of the root that is uncovered because the soil is gone there. And then you can measure the distance from those high roots, the adventitious roots, until the soil layer at that moment, and that gives you an estimate of how much of the soil has been burned. So these estimates, there's quite some measurements now, and based on that we have an idea of how much burns in these regions. And for tropical peatlands, there's definitely more work needed for tropical peatlands. There's much less field campaigns there, and at the same time, potentially much more emissions. So that's still a big thing to figure out better. But at the same time, the year-to-year variability in emissions in the tropical peatlands is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be years where there's hardly any emissions, and there can be years where there's a ton. Mostly coincides with El Niño years.
Mm-hmm. When it's drier or wetter.
Yeah, when it's drier in Indonesia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a La Niña this coming up this year. So I guess few fire emissions in that part of the world, but perhaps more in the African part of the world.
Yeah, so I guess then the east coast of Africa will be drier, southeast coast, so that would indeed maybe cause a bit more emissions there. At the same time, for the Africa part, it's a lot of human ignition, so it's actually quite stable each year how much is emitted there. It's a lot. I mean, a lot of emissions come from Africa, actually about 50% of all global fire emissions come from Africa, from savannas mostly, but that's quite a stable factor over the years. Yeah. As when you look at tropical peatlands, there's a couple of years with huge emissions, and the most famous example is 1997, which was also an El Niño year. And 2015 was a big one. And in those years, the emissions just shoot through the roof. I think in 97, the amount of emissions was similar to the total fossil fuel combustion that year, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have to look that up to be sure.
I think I also remember a very similar statistic.
Yeah, that's massive. Because in a normal fire year, fire emissions are about, say, 20%. Compared to fossil fuel emissions. So, yeah. And a lot of that is not even net emissions, but due to regrowth of vegetation, part of that is also, again, sequestered.
And in your first paper, you looked at the African continent as a bit of a case study and made estimates of the emissions lost there. Why did you choose this region, and were you also considering other regions, or it was quite clear cut that this was the region of interest?
Yeah, it basically comes down to what I said earlier, that Africa emits a lot of fire emissions. It's about 50% of total emissions each year. And the amount of area burned is even higher there. So about 70% of the global burned area occurs in Africa each year. It's just that because the amount of vegetation that burns per area is lower than for example in tropical forests in the Amazon and in the border region, because it's mostly grasslands that burn in Africa. That's why, even though burnt area is about 70% of the global, the emissions are lower, so about 50%.
Mm-hmm. And I guess because they are like human-induced fires and they're happening regularly every year, this also gives a very stable resource to test the model and train the model, whereas I guess like the areas where they're happening a bit like more irregularly, it's a bit harder to test the model because you've got infrequent data points.
Yeah, that's also part of it. For Africa, there's quite a lot of field data compared to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. That also helps, and including that also this colleague of mine, Roland, is also working in that area. That also was part of that decision to work on Africa at that moment. And also what is interesting in Africa is that a lot of the fires that are human caused are quite small in size. So that's where you would expect a big difference in estimates when you go to finer resolution model. Because then you are able to capture more of the fine scale variability in the
mm-hmm.
landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And thus get more correct emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's what you were able to do.
Yeah. We actually found we found lower emissions compared to the coarser resolution model, which had a lot to do with the calibration of the model.
And by calibration, do you mean choosing the initial parameters?
Yeah. Because this model is calibrated based on field measurements. And with the finer scale model, we were able to more closely represent those field measurements. Because, how do you say that? Because a very large pixel includes a lot of different things, even though the field plot might be in that pixel, there's also a lot of other things in that pixel.
Like different land uses.
Yeah. So tuning that quite coarse model pixel to a small field plot gives quite a big discrepancy. And when the model has a finer scale, it is possible to more closely represent that field plot, and that makes it possible to calibrate the model better, and hopefully give better estimates, more realistic estimates.
All right. Well, then I think, shall we play a song?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. This song is called Satellite by Tenato Wallace. And earlier we listened at the start of the show to Shower of Sparks by All Sparks Burn.
think it's time to make the floor burn. I think it's time to make the floor burn. I think it's time. I think it's time. I think it's time to make the floor burn. Time to make the floor burn. Burn. I think it's time to make the floor burn. think it's time to make the floor burn.
Hello, you're back. This is Soil Matters on Radio Patpu. And in the studio with me today is Dave Von Vase. And just now we were listening to Satellites by Tornado Wallace. And then we listened to Time to Make the Floor Burn by Reckless. A perfect way to take a break from our conversation about how to measure fire emissions measure and estimate fire emissions using remote sensing satellite products. So we spoke a little bit already about like your past work that you've been doing, and I know you've recently finished up another chunk of work and submitted a paper which is soon to be published.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's too early to talk about that a little bit, what you were working on in that paper.
No, we can talk a bit about that. So that paper takes a bit of a different scope, takes a much broader scope because it looks at the global CO2 balance, basically, and specifically a concept called the airborne fraction. And what it is. So there is emissions of CO2 from natural processes and also from human activity. And when we talk about human activity, that's mostly fossil fuel burning. And all these emissions go up into the atmosphere, but also a part is taken back up again by the Earth. So part of the CO2 is taken up again by the land and the ocean sinks, we call them. So for the land sink, we think about, for example, trees growing. They take up CO2, and that is stored. The carbon is stored into the biomass of the tree. And for the ocean sink, we can think about the phytoplanktons that live there, and they also take up CO2 and use that to grow, and that ends up in food chain and also in water plants. So when we look at the global balance of these two processes, the emissions from the CO2 from the Earth and again the taking up, then currently about 50% of what goes up into the atmosphere stays in the atmosphere. And that is the airborne fraction, we call it. So the fraction of CO2 that stays airborne. And in this paper, we make new estimates of the anthropogenic emissions part, and specifically the land use change part of the emissions. So when we look at anthropogenic emissions, it is mostly fossil fuel emissions, but also a part of it, about 20%, is from land use change activities. So that includes deforestation, that includes fires, conversion of forests to croplands, all these things. That's the start of it. It's quite a big chunk to explain. So we made new estimates of what goes into the atmosphere, and what stays in the atmosphere can be derived from the CO2 measurements of the atmosphere, and that is basically the famous Keeling curve. So some of you might know that is the amount of CO2 that is in the atmosphere right now. And because of our human activities, fossil fuel burning, this curve is, it's an increasing curve. And we have calculated the airborne fraction over the past 60 years, and that shows that the fraction of carbon that stays in the atmosphere remains quite constant, or is even declining a little bit. And what that says basically is that even though we're pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere, that the land and ocean sinks are able to keep up with that. They're able to take back up more CO2, keeping that fraction of CO2 in the atmosphere that stays in the atmosphere stable. And that is quite a new finding, because in the past previous work usually showed that the airborne fraction was increasing, which signals that the land and ocean sinks are working less efficiently with more CO2 available. And even though our findings are not like the final call, it's a difficult thing to calculate, and something that really should be viewed over the long term. At least for now, it's a new view on things and challenges science to look into it further.
What gives you confidence in this result?
Well, that's so. This result is really a lot based on these new land use change emissions, and especially the earlier part of these emissions. So we use a 60-year time series, so that goes back to 1960 roughly, and we make a change in the emissions from the earlier part of the time series, because that time series is now based on actual observations, even though in the past that was only based on so-called bookkeeping models, where there's estimates derived from, for example, economic activity and things like that. And now for the first time, we were able to estimate these earlier emissions based on observations.
And observations, in situ observations.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, because so it's not satellite observations, because in those time there weren't that many satellites, and not satellites capable of estimating the things we wanted to know, for example, deforestation. But instead, we used measurements of the visibility. So basically, how far you can see. If it's a misty day, then the visibility is lower, that kind of visibility. And in this case, we're talking about the visibility that is influenced by the smoke from fires. So apparently, after already from the 60s on, there have been measurements in and around the Amazon of the view distance in the atmosphere, basically, so the visibility. And that was influenced by forest fires, deforestation activity in those areas. And based on that, we can make a reconstruction of how much was deforested, and from that calculate emissions. And yeah, that sounds maybe as a very indirect way of estimating these emissions, but because these visibility observations are also available for current times and for the times where we have satellite data, we can lay those two together and see that they match up. So that gives a way to bring the estimate back to the past as well. Yeah.
Okay. So then you looked at these visibility measurements from you mentioned the Amazon, but I guess nowadays there are like observations from many different locations, but that there were some from the 60s in the Amazon region. Is that, did I catch you?
Yeah, so what we assume is that, and there's also evidence for that, is that back then, the Amazon was really the main source of land use change emissions, because in those times, a lot of other areas had quite stable emissions, and it's really the Amazon that was really important in these times in determining the global variability in the emissions, because that is really a deforestation hotspot that we know was already heavily deforested before the satellite era, before say 1990 or the 2000s. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, and then what would be the source of uncertainty in your findings?
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty still in this type of work. It would be great, of course, to have had satellites back in the 60s that could observe these things, because then we were sure what we were talking about. But it remains a bit of a guesswork somehow. But at the same time, every step we take is an improvement and towards a better estimate, and if these better estimates give a different trend scenario in the air infection, then that's the best we know now and the best that we can do for now, and even though it's up for improvement. Uncertainties mostly come from the inability or the lack of observational data before the satellite era. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and just you just formulate your relationship as best you can based on the satellite data and the observations from the present or the recent present, and assume that it holds true for other situations.
Yeah.
In the past.
Yeah, that relation is validated, or how do you say that? Validated, and then it is extrapolated to the past. And another the other source of emissions is, on the other hand, quite well known, which is the fossil fuel emission estimates. There's also still some uncertainty in that, but it's not on the same scale as the land use change uncertainties. So for fossil fuel emissions, the estimates can be quite robust because it's so well linked to economic data, basically, to the development of countries. And
I guess some countries might want to hide their information, or some countries are more revealing than others.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And that's perhaps a source of uncertainty, which is related to political unrest, perhaps.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, the nice thing about these things, it's all human activity, and that means that it's all quite well documented. I mean, for example, if a new coal-fired energy station is built, then there is some documentation of that somewhere. It can be, of course, a huge study to do that globally, but in the end, these things are quite retraceable compared to the amount of deforestation in the Amazon at some point.
Yeah, fair enough.
There's also data about soybean export or palm oil export that gives some indication of the deforestation activity, but it's not as robust as the fossil fuel use.
Yeah, and perhaps much harder to track down.
Yeah.
It's probably easier to see how many barrels of oils were sold and exchanged.
Yeah, than exactly.
How many tons of soybeans, which, as you say, also available. But
And even things as the amount of cars that are sold and stuff like that, that all gives information about how much individual things are burning fossil fuel at that moment. And it's true. I mean, country reporting can be off, and it's really important to stay critical about that. But yeah, these estimates are overall quite well estimated. Yeah, with quite low uncertainty.
I also want to just make a small side note that I was really disappointed by the COP26 outcome that developed countries can still, of course they can all, but of the developed countries that signed up to this particular agreement, that developed countries will stop building new coal-fired power plants by the end of the 2030s and developing countries by the end of the 2040s. I thought that was a really disappointing result, considering that a coal-fired power station has a approximately 50-year lifespan.
I completely agree. I think at this point the only solution is no more new coal-fired power plants now.
Considering it's just such a long lifespan, it just seems crazy we can still be building new ones for another 10 years in the developed world. Earlier we put a pin in a question to talk about at what point did you begin to take more like leadership or take more decision-making responsibilities and steer your PhD project, and what enabled or caused the shift?
I think that happened after my first paper, the one about Africa that we talked about earlier. Because it's just you delve into a topic and you get to know more of it, and then at some point you also start seeing gaps. And because you become master of the subject, you start understanding where gaps can be filled and what is currently possible. That's also where the freedom came, I think. With the knowledge gained, I guess you also gain freedom. And I was given that freedom by my supervisor, so then... you're good to go. In the end, it's always a gamble, of course. It depends on what results you get out of what you're looking into. But,
And you also, did a lot of work. I know because I was there. You also did a lot of work for, or with Scientists for Future.
Oh, yeah.
NL. Mm-hmm. How did that go? And do you feel how did that go? How was that for you? Then I'll ask the second part of the question.
Yeah, that was back in 2019 when Scientists for Future, the Netherlands branch of Scientists for Future, was really starting up basically. And it was a great experience. It was a lot of work, but it was paying back. Like the success was immense at some point. It really started super small, but then it kept growing and growing, and more people knew about it. And that was a great reward for what we were doing. At some point it took so much of my time that I decided to step out of it, because it just took up so much time that I could hardly spend any time on my PhD. And juggling those two things together was just way too stressful. And then also the corona pandemic started, and that made it even yeah, that made it even harder to get back into it again. And,
yeah. Well, how would you feel if your research was to be more applicable to a group sort of like Scientists for Future in the future?
What do you mean?
Like, if your research was a bit like, yeah, really able to be used as sort of, I guess, I sort of want to say as like a lobbying tool, but a lobbying like on behalf of like science.
Yeah.
Because that's a bit like what's, in some ways, that's kind of what science is. Not necessarily to lobby, but to like provide information to the people. And I guess Scientists for Future is a bit like to try and put an exclamation mark behind the science, try and make it a bit louder. And would you find that rewarding, or would you find it concerning if there was research, maybe not either yours or somebody else's, that is a bit more like targeted at the to present information that can be like that says all the things we're sort of trying to say now, but perhaps in a more applied way of presenting it directly, instead of speaking to the scientific community, to speak to the political community?
Yeah,
because our articles are aimed at the scientific community.
Yeah. Well, I think that that actually the IPCC reports are doing a great job at that, and I do see the link from my work to the IPCC report when it comes to fire emissions, for example. The global fire emissions database, GFET, what I'm working on is actually used as the fire emission estimates for the IPCC. So in a way, even though it's a really small and distant chunk, that work does end up in the IPCC report, and I think that's great. That feels really that makes my work feel really relevant, and yeah, I think in the end, it is best if it's really the IPCC that makes that step towards politics and not my own research. At the same time, I think it can be good if me as an individual researcher is able to speak out about certain things. But yeah, how much effect that is gonna have compared to like a organized effort like the IPCC, that is still a bit unclear for me, I think.
I guess, yeah, I really also can relate a lot to what you're saying, and I think the IPCC is a really, really fantastic effort. And I guess maybe what could be one thing is like that there would be like a Dutch version of the IPCC. And of course there are scientists that advise the cabinet, but I don't know of there being like a body that produce a synthesis of the information as it is relevant for the Netherlands.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Or like
either,
a consortium.
Actually. Yeah.
And not only the Netherlands, but also in other countries.
Yeah, I think on a country level, in the end, the IPCC report is used as the main reference, in any case. But there might be scientists that, or a panel or something, a consortium that is on a national level. Communicating that knowledge to politics, and yeah, I think that's a really good point. That's a, maybe a step that could be strengthened more. I mean, the work is there, the knowledge is there. I mean, I think the IPCC gives a good enough overview for acting, for definitely. So I don't think these national scientists should then at the same time there could be maybe more national focused data that But yeah, the step from that to politics, maybe there are some improvements there to be made.
Yeah, well, it's always a question of whose work is it to do. And it's like,
yeah,
why the hell do like a scientist, does a scientist and academic that's already working their ass off also have to like push further to get someone to listen that doesn't really seem to want to listen, or like a body of people?
Yeah. Yeah, that really screams for dedicated people, like dedicated positions for people that do that.
Yeah, it's necessary.
Yeah.
I guess like I'm trying to think of how to frame what I'm thinking of a bit better, but yeah, maybe something that's like looking at, say, then the fossil fuel industries, like two things, like, yeah, looking at like the fossil fuel industries that are like coming out of the Netherlands, and looking at the emission estimates, and also looking at more regional impacts, which of course do happen. Yeah, that does happen. But I don't know, like somehow to like synthesize all of this together in sort of some sort of IPCC like report is sort of what I'm imagining. So that then all of this, which could already exist, but I don't know about it.
Yeah.
And I think it does exist in sort of fragments actually, but yeah, that it's all together in like a strong case study consortium. Maybe that's helpful in like just pushing things a little bit further along. Who knows?
Yeah, it's true that there are some initiatives like that in the Netherlands. For example, the Planbureau, the PBL, is bringing out
really
reports about that stuff.
They do some really great work.
Which is very much the link between IPCC and national level data, I think. And then also there's the ECN, which is a research institute, and they bring out reports about sustainable energy and the future of that, which also includes like economic analysis and all kinds of things like that. So yeah, in a way the work is there. Yeah, where does it go wrong then, you think? It's I guess it's in the end, yeah, in the end the work is there, but there's different how do you say that, different interests and yeah, many many other things that politics has to address. And yeah, maybe it's then the long-term scope of the climate change problem that is pushing that subject to the background or something like that. So,
in terms of, yeah, following on, so we started talking about the case study or the focus of fire emission, yeah, focus on fire emissions in the African continent, and producing a higher resolution GFAD model, and then looking at more recently the airborne fraction of carbon emissions. And then what do you see as the next steps or next big ideas for like this train of thought and work, if you were to take another step forward further?
Yeah, so as I said, I do really like this topic, and it feels very relevant what I'm doing now. But at the same time, when you look at fires globally, a lot of these emissions from fires are not net emissions in the end. For example, in savannas, if there has been a fire, then the grass regrows afterwards. And then if you look over longer time scales, the amount of CO2 is basically neutralized. So the emissions are net zero, basically, as long as there's no changes. So the most relevant areas are really where there's a permanent change, And that is where there's deforestation, for example, such as in the Amazon and Indonesia, and also increasingly in the Congo areas and the tropical rainforests of Africa. And also the border region, where the permafrost is melting and the soils burn there. So I think I've always wanted to make as much impact as possible with my work, and I guess focusing then on these more permanent changes would feel the most fulfilling. So that's where I see myself working in the future. And I especially think the deforestation topic is very interesting, so that would probably be what I like to continue with. Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, I think that about wraps it up for today. So yeah, thanks so much for coming on, and wishing you all the best with your future projects.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's really cool.
The next song I'm gonna play, Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil. Anyone that's listening on a podcast platform, please rate the podcast so other people that are interested in similar topics can also find it easily. And yeah, you can follow Soil Matters on any podcast platform or Mixcloud or Instagram. Just look it up. And thanks everyone for tuning in.